Live from New York City, it's the Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll, and today we're going to talk about how vitamin D can give you stronger muscles from the Westmead Institute for Medical Research. And that's the beginning of a lot on health and healing today. I have a guest in the second part of our program. He is one of our Conversations with Remarkable Minds, and we're going to talk about the rise of new globalist capitalism. Last evening, I had an opportunity to do a one-hour commentary on the things I'm concerned with when we don't pay attention to the basics. For example, are you aware that the smart devices that they're inventing now are going to be all communicating one with another and feeding all that back into central computers? Well, there's a big downside to that. But if you're not even aware, or you don't even care, I don't care if my television's looking back at me. I don't care if my computer is also recording everything that I say and do. All you have to do is look up at the computer and you'll see it. You'll see a little tiny indentation, barely noticeable. They're recording everything you do. Who gives them the right to do that? Now, if you don't mind, you don't mind. But a lot of us mind. For example, when I was telling people that there are 9 careers that if you have in an option of working in, think twice, because people are being brought in from other countries who are highly educated and willing to work for half or a third of what you're working for. And they're specifically hitting long-time employees who build up seniority, getting longer vacations, etc. So now one day, someone who's been at a company and is indispensable to the company's well-being, because they're one of those people that know everything about the company, and so they can really be brought in to solve almost any problem, a young person comes in. That person's from Taiwan. Person's an honest person, hardworking, but they're willing to work for $40,000 a year with no health benefits and no paid vacation or sick days on a visa. You're making $180,000. You got 6 weeks vacation, and now you think, but I've been here 30 years. And the people who made that decision don't care. They're looking at how to increase the profit. So I told you the industries that they'd be really decimating, millions of jobs, and it's happened, and it's still happening. Then I told you about robotics. Now I'm telling you about artificial intelligence, and right after that is what's waiting in the wings, transhumanism. And it's not starting, it's done. You see, once Silicon Valley completes something, it might have taken them 5, 10, 20 years. They then have to create a public relations program to sell it to you. They have to make it seem like what they've just invented is essential for you to feel good and make life easier. They never tell you the side effects, like 5G. Hence, I'm doing a lot of program, wrote a definitive article, and I'm collecting all the testimonies before Congress of leading scientists like Dr. Deborah Davis, so you can go there and find out for yourself. But we're always trying to stay several steps ahead. You're not going to learn any lesson if you sit and watch the tsunami come back at you. You got to get out of harm's way. So right now I'm saying government overreach, asset forfeiture, the right to stop and frisk, the right to search you, the evisceration of our Constitution, our First Amendment. If they don't like what you're saying, they'll call it hate speech, even if there's nothing hateful in it, because they determine what hate is. And so we better pay attention. Now, tomorrow on our sister station WBAI, where I'm approaching 44 years, by the way, we're going to play last night's program, because a lot of people don't have easy access to the Internet. I want you to hear that, if for nothing else, just to make you aware of what's happening so you can decide to take an issue and address an issue. Take any issue you want. There's going to be a lot of support out there, and your support will help them. So anyhow, that's what I'm going to talk with Professor William Robinson today about. He's professor of sociology and Latin American studies at the University of California at Santa Barbara. He also is one of the leading experts in the world on how the third world struggles for social justice and what has happened around the world. But today we're going to talk about understanding classical capitalism and the new global capitalism. They are not the same. And for those who are listening to the debates on radio and television by these individuals who claim to be knowledgeable, we're going socialism. No, we're going capitalism. And point of fact, we have been both a combination, a hybrid of capitalism that then is able to support socialism forever. And so I want to talk what happens when we leave out the socialism part in other countries and what's coming to the United States. So I think you'll find this a very interesting interview. And time permitting, we're also going to go to our audio files because Google has now been exposed as trying to manipulate the upcoming election against Trump. Fine. I don't like Trump. Many of you don't like Trump. There's nothing to like. But what about the people who believe that what he is representing is something that is in alignment with their own values, even if it's a protest against the corruption that is endemic within the corporate Democratic Party? Shouldn't they have the right? Yes, they should. And we have the right to vote for who we want. I never vote for the Democrats or Republicans because they're both compromised. That's why I'll support, and I don't never tell people who to vote for, but I have voted for Ralph Nader, Rocky Anderson, Jill Stein, and I'll continue to vote for those who stand aside from the influence of being captured by corporate and special interest. But what happens when Google is shown to be in violation of the charter that Congress passed that it couldn't be sued? Now it's in violation. And now they were caught. And now there are hearings today as we speak in Washington. And the person who's representing Google said, I heard about this scandal. Yeah, what a scandal. RTV is going to bring this segment to us for about 5 minutes later today. And then from Professor Juliet Shore, four kinds of wealth. It's a short clip, 2 minutes, but it's the first part of a whole series we're doing on why so many Americans are broke and what we need to do to get out of that position. As you see, I'm giving you a coming attraction today and tomorrow. Tomorrow I'm going to be doing a really hard-hitting piece, the whole hour, on a single topic, sugar. However, I will also be doing an expose on PBS, on all the major news media, and the people representing the Sugar Institute. That'll all be in that one-hour expose tomorrow. So therefore, if someone says, I didn't know sugar was bad. Why? I didn't think it would be that bad. Well, then you've been engaging in intentional ignorance, in which case tomorrow that intentional ignorance will be reversed. You'll be intentionally aware. Therefore, you can protect yourself. We begin with this interesting article involving our muscles. And in this regard, according to the study done at the Westmead Institute for Medical Research, they find that vitamin D is essential for muscles. Now, we know it's good for the heart, and we know it's good for the immune system, absolutely. But now we find out that vitamin D in muscles helps the signaling, meaning how cells communicate one with another. And it's normal for having this signaling because it determines your muscle size and strength. Ah, so you mean people with smaller muscles and people losing their muscles and people with less strength in those muscles may be deficient in vitamin D. That's correct. So you want stronger muscles, better muscles, healthier muscles? Vitamin D each day. From the Graduate Institute of Pharmaceutical Chemistry in Taiwan comes an interesting study about allo-isothiocyanate. Now, that's present in your cruciferous vegetables, but they find it induces cell toxicity in breast cancer cell lines, meaning in lay language, when you're taking in these sulfur groups, it's killing the cancer cells, especially breast cancer cells. Now, there's indole-3-carbinol, I3C, that also works. But they found in these cruciferous vegetables, it was really powerful. By the way, this was published in the American Journal of Chinese Medicine. And the isothiocyanates are compounds that have been shown to exhibit strong anti-cancer effects, including the induction of what is known as a programmed cell death. It causes the cancer cell to commit suicide. That's a good thing. And so the more garlic, onions, broccoli, cauliflower, Brussels sprouts, asparagus, kale, arugula, mustard, and radishes that you consume, the more likely you are to prevent breast cancer, or if you have it, to help you in the fight against it. That's good. Now, there's just a little side issue here. If you went up to see if this study you could find, and you went to Google and it took you to Wikipedia, you would find that they're against Chinese medicine, traditional Chinese medicine. They don't believe in it. They don't believe it's been supported, even though there are hundreds of thousands of studies, including laboratories far more advanced than any we have in America. They know more about herbs like astragalus, one of the most important herbs in the world, with thousands of studies on its antiviral and antibacterial effects. And this was published in a peer-reviewed journal, the American Journal of Chinese Medicine. And yet they will deny all this. One more reason why. 30 articles into us exposing the bias, institutional bias, of Jimmy Wales and his editors working on health issues, that you should think twice about giving them any money, think twice about using them, because there's an enormous amount of conflict. And I was just sent an article from someone inside Wikipedia about the problems women editors have there. More on that coming up. Harvard School of Public Health has shown that alpha-linolenic acid is associated with a lower multiple sclerosis risk. That's important. According to news reporting out of Boston, the plant-based omega-3 fatty acid, alpha-linolenic acid, ALA, can help lower your risk of multiple sclerosis. And I'm a big believer in making sure that you have the right fatty acids in the body if you have multiple sclerosis. So this study showed that it made a difference. Now, we're always hearing about people who have CVD, cardiovascular disease. And what do we do about it? Well, according to an article just published today in the Chinese Journal of Natural Medicine from the University of South China, red yeast rice. Again, red, R-E-D, yeast, Y-E-A-S-T, rice, R-I-S-E-E. Now, that's a traditional Chinese food commonly used for lowering cholesterol. Now we know that it also helps prevent cardiovascular disease. And it's now been confirmed that red yeast rice is a very healthy, functional food for prevention and treatment of cardiovascular disease such as atherosclerosis. And atherosclerosis is a condition in which plaque or fatty deposits build up and clog the arteries, resulting in a thicker, narrower arterial wall. And your endothelial injury continues throughout the disease. Therefore, improving endothelial function is essential in the prevention of disease. So, several different hospitals and universities participated in the study and found that red yeast rice really makes a difference in treating cardiovascular disease. I would also use at the same time that I would be using that, and one of the reasons red yeast rice works, I've suggested many times, is it reduces oxidative stress and inflammation, but it also increases nitric, N-I-T-R-I-C, oxide, or what is known as NO. Nitric oxide maintains normal vasodilation, meaning it opens up your arteries and functions and helps prevent platelet aggregation and adhesion, which can cause a clot, cause a stroke. These are very beneficial. And I would add on to that the phytosterols, the isoflavones, the condensed tannins, coenzyme Q10, and some of the other important polyphenols, ketides. These are all natural components that can help our heart. From Columbia University Medical Center, the heart risk raised by sitting in front of the television. This we didn't need another study on. We know that sitting for more than 2 hours is dangerous. That's why you should get up, exercise yourself. But this just confirms this. You really need vigorous exercise. Also, zero-calorie sweeteners are on trial again. The U.S. National Institutes of Diabetes and Digestion and Kidney Disease talked about a research on these sugar substitute and the zero-calorie sweeteners. They can reduce tooth decay and blood sugar spikes. And this was published in Frontiers in Microbiology. And it reinforces an emergent consensus. Artificial sweeteners you should not be using all the time. They are not a magic bullet. Oh, I want something that has no sugar, so I'm going to use an artificial sweetener. Now, yeah, if it's stevia, that's fine, but what if it's not? So do not be using these artificial sweeteners unless they're natural. And finally, probiotics may prevent breast cancer. This is from Western University in Ontario. This is a new study has found that probiotics can prove to be a critical factor in preventing breast cancer. So use your probiotics. They can help save your life. That's the latest on health and healing. I'm Gary Noll. We're going to take a break. And when we come back, we're going to go right into this segment on Google influencing the 2008 midterms. I don't want any platform, Facebook, Google, I want none of these platforms to be manipulating algorithms so that they promote one candidate over the other. That is not their job. That is not their mandate. And they keep saying they're not doing this, yet they keep being exposed for doing it. Back in a moment.
Through its biosearch results. That is the finding of new research in three key congressional races in Southern California. The author of the study plans to present it in full next month. Now, the study analyzed around 50,000 election-related searches and web pages linked to them. Three search engines were compared: Google, Bing, and Yahoo. Those behind the research concluded that in the three districts in focus, more than 35,000 undecided voters may have been persuaded who to give their backing to, which could potentially apply to millions when you consider the scene across the country. This research is not the first made by this author against Google. However, the tech giant has dismissed his previous findings, saying that its algorithms are politically blind.
We have never re-ranked search results on any topic, including elections, to manipulate political sentiment. Moreover, we do not make any ranking tweaks which are specific to elections or political candidates, period. We always strive to provide our users with the most accurate, relevant answers to their queries.
Well, who better to speak to than the actual author of that study, Dr. Robert Epstein, senior research psychologist at the American Institute for Behavioral Research and Technology, joins me on the line. Great to have you on, Dr. Epstein. Google completely disagrees with you, I should say, first of all. They said there's no way this can be true, but you disagree. Is it really possible the results of Google searches can influence the way people vote?
Well, there's no question about that. I've been doing randomized controlled studies for more than 6 years, measuring quite precisely the impact that they can have on people's thinking and behavior and purchases and elections. But this monitoring project that I conducted, this shows beyond any question that there was significant liberal bias in Google search results, but not in search results from Bing and Yahoo. Unfortunately, about 90% of search is conducted on Google, not Bing and Yahoo. So Google really is the deciding factor in close races. In fact, we calculate that upwards of 25% of the national elections in the world are being decided without people's knowledge by Google's search algorithm.
Can you give an example of how somebody might be influenced? So you go on the internet, you go on Google. What kind of things were people searching for? News stories?
Well, we did this very, very carefully. We had field agents focusing on three congressional races in California, which were very hotly contested races in Republican districts. And we gave to these field agents about 500 election-related search terms. Each one had different search terms for different districts, where there are different issues, of course. And the point is, we simply looked at what kind of search results they received when they were conducting election-related searches. And we found very consistently that on Google, they ended up with search results favoring liberals and favoring liberal news sources, and it was quite a dramatic effect. And by the way, that disclaimer, that denial that you just played from Google, you have to listen very, very, very carefully to what they're saying. They're saying they don't re-rank. They're very careful, you know, in their denials. We don't re-rank. I've never claimed they re-rank anything. I'm just reporting on what they actually show people, and what they show people is dramatically biased enough in our 2018 elections to have shifted upwards of 78.2 million votes spread across different races in the U.S. in 2018.
Can we establish with any certainty just how much influence what people see in their internet searches, what impact it has upon who they vote for?
Well, yes, that's what the scientific research has been all about. And we know that among people who are undecided on an issue, if we show them search results that favor one cause or favor one candidate, like Brexit, for example, among people who are undecided, that easily can shift 20% or more of them in the direction of the bias, upwards of up to 80% shifts in some demographic groups. People trust algorithmic output. They trust Google. They think it's because it's generated by a computer. They don't see the human hand. They think it's impartial and objective, and then their opinions change. So we've measured that quite precisely now in five national elections in multiple countries. And so we know for sure that that is occurring now around the world without people's knowledge.
Okay, we'll have to wrap things up there, unfortunately. Great to speak to you, though. The author of that study, Dr. Robert Epstein, is my guest, senior research psychologist at the American Institute for Behavioral Research and Technology. Thank you.
Now, on another level, I'm going to run through just some headlines from today, but not headlines from our major media, but rather from qualified alternative media. For example, this is from Ben Norton, very respected journalist, from Greystone, quote, "The New York Times admits it sends stories to the U.S. government for approval before publication." Quote, "The New York Times has publicly acknowledged that it sends some of its stories to the U.S. government for approval from, quote, national security officials before publication. This confirms what veteran New York Times correspondent like James Risen has said, the American newspaper of record regularly collaborates with U.S. government, suppressing reporting that top officials don't want made public. So, here we have it. The New York Times cooperates with the CIA, the National Security Agency, Homeland Security, and other departments, so that they, the government, gets to decide, is an article going to be harmful to their interest? And if it is, it can get spiked. So much for the New York Times. This is another article today, and this is from Low Blog, Robert Wright. When National Public Radio, NPR, is more dangerous than Fox News. Quote, when military conflict between the United States and Iran seems to be approaching, and even you're trying to get a clear picture of the situation, I'm only half kidding when I say that there's a case to be made for staying glued to Fox News. Sure, you'll hear a lot of pro-war propaganda, but at least you'll know that that's what it is. If you instead tuned in to mainstream media, you might think you're getting an objective account when in fact you're getting an account that's being biased in favor of war, just biased in subtler, harder to detect ways than the accounts of Fox News. Disclaimer, I'm not saying that mainstream journalists and commentators who evince these biases are consciously anti-Iran or pro-war. Usually the problem is just that they're Americans viewing the world through American lenses, relying upon Americans' ecosystem of expertise. And, of course, they're human, which means they have cognitive biases that distort reality in accordance with their group affiliations. And then it goes into showing how the reports that they give and the people they use to comment on them are all pro-industry. I'll give you an example of this. There's only one person thus far, there may be others, I just haven't seen them, there's only one person in this whole lead-up to wanting to go to war in Iran, and that's what our entire corporate-controlled Washington consensus wants. Hundreds of thousands of contractors and companies and, in effect, millions of people benefit from war. It's not personal to them. It's a paycheck and a very big one. After all, if you're Eric Prince and you can send in private mercenaries, many of them are former, you know, special ops operators, and if you were in the regular army, you might make $150 a day. He's going to pay you, let's say, $1,500 a day plus bonuses. Well, then it's a very lucrative situation. Now, if he then gets the government to say, look, you don't go in there. We'll go in there. We'll make sure that this regime change happens in Venezuela. Or we'll get rid of Assad in Syria. How many of those black op, off-the-shelf things have happened? Plausible deniability. We had no boots on the ground. But there were Americans on the ground. Yeah, but they were private contractors for the Department of Defense. Well, what is the difference? You know, it's still the United States government. The taxpayers are paying for it, and a lot of money. Nobody ever considers how much money the Pentagon has lost. And so when they say the American intelligence shows that our drone was in international waters, how do we know? Because there was a meeting at the UN with the Iranian UN ambassador who had photographs and proof that said that the drone was not in international waters. It was in Iranian territory and waters, and it was shot down. Why wouldn't it be interesting just to take the two different accounts and put them side by side, see which one's right? But we won't do that. We will always bring in a whole list of people to be pro-war. The only non-pro-war person was Tucker Carlson. He brought in a colonel who explained all the reasons why we should not go to war in Iran. It would be a disaster, and any reasonable person knows. Nor should we be doing any of the other things with regime change around the world. But he's a colonel. But now you have all the generals and the people who are given large amounts of money every year to go around and be the expert that this is a threat to America's security and we need to do it. And NPR will have those people on. So it's very biased. Also, here's something interesting from The Guardian. It's totally unfair. Chicago, where the rich live 30 years longer than the poor. And this is where it starts. Because when they took a look, well, how come the rich live 30 years longer? Well, because how about they can move when in harm's way? How many rich people have places outside of the metropolitan area so if there is a hurricane, a tornado, a fire, they have another place to go? They're not going to miss anything. They'll always have money to buy food because food's always being grown somewhere else in the world, even if it's not being grown right now in Missouri, in Arkansas, because of the floods that have been going on and still are in a saturating ground. There's nowhere for the water to go. So we don't think about how those farmers are being affected and how many will be bankrupt and how many will get out of farming because somewhere else in the world someone will grow food and we'll bring it in. We'll just pay more for it. So what else is going on in Chicago that allows a person to live a shorter life? And I'm not just referring to gunshots, because that's not really statistically, when you count the total number of people living in Chicago versus those that are killed, there are other factors like socioeconomic factors, educational factors, opportunity factors, and bias factors, and income inequality factors. So yeah, when someone can live 30 years longer, well, shouldn't that be a big issue? It should, and it's not an issue at all. Also, we have this today. This is from Max Blumenthal, a highly respected journalist. I respect Max because his work's almost always very accurate. And he says this, Western-funded nonprofit, meaning a very famous nonprofit organization, has been collaborating with Al-Qaeda to wage, wage a campaign in Syria. Quote, mainstream reporting on Syria has relied heavily upon the work of the Commission for International Justice and Accountability, a Western government-funded, that means CIA-funded, regime change group whose investigators collaborated with Al-Qaeda and its extremist allies, those are the headcutters, to drum up prosecutions of Syrian officials. So every time you hear that Assad fired, canisters with poison gas, sarin gas. No, he didn't. Now, if you listen to this program, you've heard six separate investigative journalists who were in Syria, in the war zone, and did the investigation, showed that it wasn't Assad or the Syrian government using chemical warfare. It was the CIA and British and French-backed and Saudi Arabia and United Arab Emirates-backed terrorist groups, as many as six different terrorist groups, and all had something in common. They were all being protected by America and its allies, and they were promoting the White Helmets, an actual terrorist group, and the entire story we got was wrong. So if you're getting that story wrong, then can you assume you're going to get any story, honestly, out of these control groups? And the people that get the money are, they're the ones that everyone goes to. Oh, there's something happening in Syria. Let's go to that group. What if that group's been funding terrorists? Shouldn't that in and of itself be enough to bring them to The Hague and the international tribunals? But then we find out those are corrupt as well. And also we have this, and this is not getting any attention. This is from John Harris, and it says, quote, if Facebook or Google create their own currency, they can control our lives. Oh, by the way, Facebook already is creating Libra, L-I-B-R-A, its own cryptocurrency. Quote, Facebook's Libra is the last thing the world needs. Big tech's use of our data threatens to introduce even on financial transactions. Dystopian fiction. And no, it's not dystopian fiction. It's real. So now they're saying Libra will be pegged to a basket of mainstream currencies at a value of about a dollar and rooted in the model of secure, immutable online transactions we know as blockchain. Why would anyone trust Mark Zuckerberg's company, Facebook, when they've already been found repeatedly to be spying on people, collecting data without our authorization or knowledge, against the rules, and then now they're censoring anyone who questions vaccine safety or GMOs safety. They're censored. And then they go on the attack, creating actual content, which is against their charter. So why isn't that on anyone's talking point? So you see, I'm looking at the world a little different. I'm looking at the people who are actually doing things on a day-to-day basis that we should all be concerned about, but are not. This is all lost in the ether of the of all the other things that go on in our lives each day. So we're going to talk about these things in depth and why we should start paying attention to these, because this is important. And we're going to take a break and come right back, and we're going to have our guest up, and so he can share his perspective on this. I'm Gary Knoll. We're glad that you're on board. Please share the programs. And by the way, before we go to our break, yesterday I posted on our PRN.fm and Gary Knoll site the latest investigative reporting article challenging Facebook. And it was about Facebook's bias when it comes to vaccines. And I simply took everything they had said, which showed gross bias, and the leading proponent of vaccines, Paul Offit, and they're using him as their objective qualified experts on vaccines. This man has no qualifications of being without bias because he has gross conflict of interest, including multi-million dollar deals. And he owns patents on vaccines, has. So why would you use someone who is steeped in a conflict of interest as your expert? In any case, that's, I think, number 30 or 31 or 32 in the series. I've lost track. I've done so many. Share it with people. Share all those articles. Send them to everyone you know. This is how we start the process of challenging these monolithics, agencies that are as powerful as the government. After all, Google is the most powerful corporation in the world, and it believes that it is also now trying to tell us who we should elect. And that's wrong. Back with our guest in a moment. Please stay with us. We're going out to Santa Barbara, California, where Professor William Robinson is standing by. As I mentioned earlier, he is the professor of sociology and Latin American studies at the University of California, Santa Barbara. He is also on the university's faculty in its global and international studies program. He is a scholar, activist, deeply involved in third world struggles for social justice and the Latin American radical left, popular, powerful movements around the world. And he focuses upon globalizations and transnationalism and political economics and immigration and a variety of sociological issues. And he is also an author. His important articles often appear on Global Research. He's published 9 books, his latest being In the Tempest, Essays on the New Global Capitalism. And his website is soc.ucsb.edu/faculty/Robinson. Nice to have you with us again.
Pleasure to be on, Gary. Thank you.
We're going to introduce listeners to a major shift in our conventional understanding of classical capitalism and speak about the new global capitalism. Underlying this term is a war being waged by the global wealthy corporate elite and the rest of the planet, especially against the dispossessed in developing countries by a sort of economic colonialism, but also right here in the United States as well. Some of you may have seen a documentary film by John Pilger called The Coming War with China. Pilger interviews one of China's most popular economists, who was educated, I recall, at Harvard or another Ivy League school, and this economist draws a very important distinction between what the West perceives as capitalism from the Chinese perspective. He said, in the United States and other Western nations, capital controls our governments. In China, the government controls capital. William, this statement seems to, let's say, it seems to fall right in line with our analysis of the new world we are entering, ruled by a new global capitalism. And today it's not the U.S. which really controls its economy, as the majority of Americans believe. Rather, it is this multinational global network of elites that really pull the strings. So please define for us this new era of global capitalism that we have entered, and what were the fundamental errors in the nation states, especially the United States, that contributed to both our domestic economy as well as global economy now being dominated by private interests that undermine and even destroy the public good? The forum is yours.
Sure. Well, let me first say something about the new book, Into the Tempest, Essays on the New Global Capitalism. I've been writing about the now globalized capitalism for the past few decades, and I wanted to write a book that's more accessible to a politically engaged public and to social justice activists that are not necessarily have theoretical training. So this capitalist system, the world capitalist system, has been around for over 500 years now, but in the late 20th century and now intensifying right up to date, it has entered a new stage. And this is a new stage that I refer to as global or globalized capitalism, and it's characterized by a number of new things that have taken place in the capitalist system that you have briefly touched on. And one is that we have the rise of this truly global economy, a globalized production and financial system. Every country is now integrated into it. China is rapidly integrating into it. In fact, China's integration into this new globalized production and financial system is part of the story of U.S.-China tensions. But the second dimension that is new and that you also just touched on briefly is that we have the rise now of the new transnational capitalist class. And this is the new global ruling class, and it imposes its agenda on nations, including, for that matter, the U.S. state. And the concentrated economic power of this transnational capitalist class is simply phenomenal. In fact, a colleague of mine recently presented the data that 309 individuals that are drawn from the upper echelons of the transnational capitalist class now stand at the very apex of the global power structure. And they manage just 17 global financial and corporate conglomerates that have $41.1 trillion. That's over half of the total global GNP, the total global wealth. And they're cross-invested in each other. So, and they are this transnational capitalist class runs the giant global corporations that control and drive the global economy. So that's the real power at the core of this now globalized capitalism. It's not nation states. It's not even the U.S. state. The U.S. state does the bidding of the transnational, capitalist class. So, you know, you were saying what's gone on in nation states and in the United States, but one of the things is we used to not have a transnational capitalist class. We had national capitalist classes, and working classes and the poor struggled in each country around the world and pressured their states that put some controls on the corporate class, on the capitalist class. But these capitalists went global in the late 20th century, and they're accelerating this process now. And once they go global, they can now reverse all of the concessions or compromises they had to make in the earlier era, for instance, in the 20th century. So they have this unbridled power at this point. And, you know, this helps understand a wide range of things that are going on worldwide. Of course, there's right now the threats of war against Iran. There's this war, brutal war against immigrants. I just want to mention that in this new book, Into the Tempest, what I'm trying to do besides presenting an accessible version of this global capitalism theory to show how this theoretical perspective and the analysis of a transnational capitalist class helps us understand all of these current political dynamics, the rise of Trumpism, the threat of 21st century fascism, the trade wars that are going on and so forth. So, I mean, the idea here is that we want to intervene in what's going on worldwide and fight for social justice and fight the powers that be. We have to have some type of a theoretical understanding, and that's the idea of presenting this theory of global capitalism.
Thank you. I appreciate the introduction. 3 years ago, Richard Galen and I decided to try to find out who are the most powerful people in the world. You would immediately think of George Soros and the Koch brothers. And we found that these people don't even have what would amount to pocket change compared to the people who are really the most powerful, but who you've never heard of. And it came down to 142 companies. But like you just mentioned, they are all invested in each other, and they have interlocking boards, and they're all over the world, and they are frequently not using a name. Years ago, the Rockefeller family evidently made a decision that they didn't want their name on everything, so they would buy controlling interest in a corporation, whether it was insurance or medical supplies, petroleum, whatever it was. And as long as they controlled the board, and as long as they controlled the majority of, let's say, the shares, then it didn't matter. They didn't have to have their name on the front of the building. It was theirs. The Rothschilds did the same thing. Very few things actually have the Rothschild name on it, or the Warburg, or J.P. Morgan. So these are the people that control it. When you talk about these small number of people, give us some names so we know the names of individuals and the names of companies, because when you say that there's over $40 trillion, and when you consider our gross domestic product in the United States is about $21 trillion, that means that a small group of individuals are controlling more wealth than what the United States takes in a two-year period plus. And also, by extension, I do not believe that these people are not fully in control of all body politics, left and right. They select the people who will then run the think tanks through the think tanks, like the Council on Foreign Relations or the Business Roundtable. They then decide who is going to be the best spokesperson on these issues. And then they have whole categories of issues. If it's about energy independence, if it's about going green, if it's about reducing military bases around the world, these are the group of people that we will bring up. Then those people are groomed, the generals and the sociologists and behavioralists. So no matter where you go for an expert, you're going to someone who's going to protect their investment and seem like a reasonable person to most people when they're making some statements, and yet they control the entire game. Would you address that, please?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, and the reason we don't know the names of these people is because we want to understand the relationship between the upper echelons of this transnational capitalist class that controls especially the global financial conglomerates. Blackstone, J.P. Morgan, there's 17 of these global financial conglomerates. And they're not just cross-invested with each other, but then they're also invested in media, in industry, in commerce, of course, in the global military-industrial security complex. That goes a long way in explaining what's going on, for instance, with this attempt to launch a war against Iran. But here's the key thing. The names that we hear are those of politicians or those of maybe a handful of charismatic global capitalists, particularly in the tech sector, such as Bezos from Amazon or so forth. But they have political agents, and the political agents are the politicians that run governments around the world, including the U.S. government. They have their intellectual representatives, which, as you just identified, run their think tanks and their foundations, and they have their military representatives, which are generals. So those people are the names that come up. They're basically their political agents, and they are behind the scenes. But I want to mention something else also, and that is that we don't want to get the impression that this global capitalism and the power structure behind it and the transnational capitalist class behind it is all powerful, because the system is actually in crisis right now. And one of the outcomes of this mounting crisis of the system is that the transnational capitalist class, these massive conglomerates, have brought about a global war economy, meaning that in order for them to continue making endless profit, they are increasingly investing in war, in systems of repression, and systems of social control worldwide. And so most people focus on the geopolitics of the growing confrontation between the United States and Iran, or the geopolitics of trade wars between China and the United States. And those geopolitical dimensions are important, but underlying those geopolitical dimensions is that war and repression and social control is becoming ever more central to the whole global economy. It's what I call militarized accumulation and accumulation by repression. So right now, one of the faces of this global capitalism, and here's the important thing to connect the underlying structure of global capitalism with political and with cultural dynamics and with electoral outcomes and with geopolitical conflicts and so forth. So what's on top of everyone's mind right now is this news of the unbelievable brutal and criminal treatments of migrants, especially children migrants, on the border with U.S.-Mexico. But what the media is not capturing there is that the companies that are running these jails, they're called immigrant detention centers, but they're really jails and concentration camps, are privatized corporations, including Corrections Corporation of America and GEO Group and others. These privatized corporations, for every body, immigrant body locked up every night, they get over $100. So their interest is simply to turn refugees and migrants into simple, dehumanized bodies in order to make profit. But here's the thing to address what you're raising. In turn, these private prison companies and immigrant repression companies are linked to the global financial conglomerates, and they're linked to the military-industrial complex. It's all a mass of interlocking global finance capital here. So when the U.S. government and when the Trump regime passes and pushes the anti-immigrant agenda, they are doing the bidding of the transnational capitalist class, and a lot of the media doesn't get it. It just focuses on as if this is an autonomous decision by Trump or by the U.S. government. But behind that is this whole structure of economic and capitalist interests.
By the way, it's not $100. We did the math. It's $750 per every person that they lock up in these cages and under the most inhumane and despicable conditions. And by the way, just so we put this in proper context, I posted a photograph today of Barack Obama's Department of Homeland Security director going through the cages that he built, and you see the children in the cages with with Obama's top person there. So spread the shame to all of these: Hillary Clinton, Bill Clinton, Barack Obama. They are all guilty of malfeasance against the basic human rights of another person. And anyhow, as you said, the people making the money are the privateers. My final question is, is it fair to say that our elected officials, or most of our elected officials and leaders, are little more than indentured serfs to this transnational class? And if so, what relationship does this have with our regressive and draconian policies, such as increasing privatization of our schools, of our prisons, of our public utilities, of our healthcare system, that protects pharmaceutical revenues over individuals' health and well-being, and worse, now that it should be clear to Americans that they are living in a quasi-authoritarian police state, what is its relationship to this new manifestation of capitalism?
Absolutely. I mean, this is there's a quote I have in the book that I don't remember his name, but he's top official of one of these 17 cross-invested global financial conglomerates. And he describes U.S. presidents in the following way. He says, they are the pilots of our planes, of our jets. This is coming from the mouth of one of these transnational capitalists. So it clearly shows the relationship of the U.S. state, but all states, all your political elites around the world are simply doing the bidding in exchange for high status and power and winning elections, and in exchange, of course, for sinecures of the transnational capitalist class. So, but one of the things that's happened is that The system is in crisis. It's in crisis, and I've spoken about this previously on your program, because 1% of humanity has over 50% of the world's wealth. Another 20%, which are not the ruling elite, but comfortable, able to survive in this new system, has 95% of the world's wealth. And then the 80% of humanity has only 5%. Your listeners are going to be familiar with that data. But what that means is that that $41 trillion in profits in assets cannot be reinvested because the mass of humanity cannot consume. So it pushes the transnational capitalist class to find new ways to accumulate capital to make profit in the face of growing stagnation and growing economic crisis. And so that is why they're pushing now more than ever for the privatization, deeper privatization of health, of the educational system, pushing for this militarized accumulation, because those are new ways of unloading all of the profit they have in a situation in which the mass of humanity can't consume and in a situation in which the system is facing this deep structural stagnation. So all of these things are linked. War is linked with the privatization of health and education, with the dispossession of the majority, and it's linked to this process of a globalized capitalism unleashed from any nation-state controls, from any controls from below, and it's for that matter, it's also linked to the environmental crisis. I know we have no time to go into that, but this is the larger backdrop we need to understand if we want to face all of these different different particular issues of injustice that we are fighting.
Thank you very much for coming on, William, and sharing it. I really appreciate your insights. And William's new book, Professor William Robinson, is called Into the Tempest, Essays on the New Global Capitalism. Thank you very much. We're out of time, everyone. Thank you for listening. Look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Have a nice day.
Help me, please. But he winds up knocking me back down on my knees. Lord, there have been times that I thought I could last for long. I'm coming.
but I know.